Hello, everyone. My name is Lino Ferro, the host of Cribwolf Talks. Every month, we present an episode of Cribwolf Talks that focuses on the many issues that center around the lack of deeply affordable housing, specifically living arrangements with supports as needed, and other topics regarding the quality of life faced by members of our vulnerable population, primarily individuals with developmental disabilities and mental challenges. We search for subject matter based on events that are current and have a direct or indirect correlation on our vulnerable population. We've invited guests to appear on our show and will continue this format for future programs, specifically guests who provide our audience with a better understanding of those issues faced by our vulnerable population. On today's program, I'll be revisiting our very first webcast as part of our year in review series, where I had the privilege of interviewing the CEO of Reen Organization, Mr. Brian Keshen. For today's program, I've asked two of my good friends to join me as part of our discussion panel. On our panel is Matt George, co-founder and director of Cribwolf Foundation, and Sunil Balakrishnan, director of Cribwolf Foundation. Gentlemen, nice to have both of you on our program today.
Thanks, Lino. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to be here, Lino.
Great. So let's begin our Brian Keshen and the Reen episode by watching this first clip on Brian's journey.
So I think I was born into it. So my mom was the chair of the Association for Children with Learning Disabilities in Ontario. And when she started to get involved in that, it was during the deinstitutionalization period of the 70s.
Okay.
And she was asked to sit on a board of the starting organization, no name yet, ultimately became RENA. And she sat on the board and they started to put together a plan. And the first plans were to establish two group homes and a summer camp. They went out to recruit executive director, and they couldn't find anyone. So the main charitable leader of this organization, the donor who helped get it started, said, "This lady seems to know what she's doing. She won't cost us much. We'll pay her a little money. She can be the executive director."
Wow.
Well, so 42 years later, she had built an organization that was 26 million, 480 staff, and had built multiple buildings. I mean, the houses and the projects that she built were tremendous in the community. And it's not her. I mean, it really is about a community of passionate board members, about staff, about the families. It's all working together. So she had the opportunity. So you're asking my career path? I was born into that.
Wow.
11 years old, I was doing door knocking.
11?
Yeah, 11. I was knocking on doors to advocate to allow, at the time, you didn't have rights of zoning. You couldn't put a group home in communities easily. It was all the NIMBYisms and all that. And I remember knocking on doors and talking about it. And then we did fundraising. And I remember being the person who dragged all the goods out. We did these fairs and events. You know, I still think the best job I ever did with RENA, and the one I think I feel most complete about, it was the chief bottle washer. Literally, I was in the kitchen in the camp, and I was the assistant cook. And my job was to make sure at the end of the night, the kitchen was clean. It's the only time I've had a job where I knew it was finished at the end at RENA. Every other job, there's so much more to do. There's another thing to another challenge, another opportunity. So it became part of me. It just grew up. My bedroom was a respite. When my mom often went to places and found someone who was in distress in one of these institutional settings, she said, "They're coming home now." And what that meant is, "Brian, you're moving out of your bedroom." Literally, some of my furniture is spread out throughout the group homes of RENA today.
Well, gentlemen, allow me to break the ice on this first discussion about Brian's journey.
Sure.
So when I hear this journey, the word that comes to my mind is inspiration. I think we all get inspired by different things and in diverse ways. It may look or feel unique for everyone, but if you sense that yearning and compassion to do something for those in need, it can ignite a passion within you that can be a lifelong fulfillment. Sacrificing things we take for granted, such as giving up your bedroom for the night to someone in distress, like Brian had mentioned, is inspiring. Seeing firsthand at an early age how impactful these small gestures can do for someone leads to more inspirational acts of kindness. Uh-huh. All it takes to start is one person. Then another person sees this, gets inspired, and desires to do something wonderful. These are the roots to developing a passionate community. Mm-hmm. Now, Brian mentions how their initial two group home model has evolved to what they call RENA today. And that's all thanks to their passionate board members who have been working hard to serve their community. Now, hearing Brian's story inspires us, our group, so that we can make our plans for building a multi-unit residential facility. We have passionate members on our board and a common goal. And I'm definitely not going to forget our growing Cribwolf community members who are inspired to join our journey to reaching our goals.
Wow, Sonal. That was very insightful. There's another clip that I found quite interesting. It has to do with the actual definition of persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities that Brian was talking about. Let's take a quick look at that clip.
I don't know if the words matter. It's how we feel about the words. So let's be careful, because now the word individual is used a lot to replace the term person supporter, or often whatever term, and now people are feel uncomfortable. It's how you use the word. I can be called all sorts of nasty things by my best friends, but I know they're doing it with love. So it doesn't matter what we call people, but I think it's important to recognize that each of us has support needs ultimately at some point in our life. Right. We've had it when we were a child. We'll have it when we're a senior. Some of us have more needs, and over our lifetime, those things change. Those people with disabilities that impact their life ability, their ability to manage their own life, to cook, to shop, to bank, to do basic, to get employment maybe, if it affects that permanently throughout their life, those are the people we're talking about that need support if it comes from a cognitive, whatever title you want to use, that's what about. So they have varied abilities. They have strengths. They have weaknesses. They have personalities, right? Your son, So he's got a personality.
He's wonderful, exactly.
Right. Yeah. So
I actually brought a lot of clarity to it. I'm glad you answered that way. It's really good.
Okay, so I do agree with Brian about it's how we use the words at the end of the day that matters. Although the government tends to have terms like mental or physical disability, which is like an overarching umbrella to categorize support services and funding, then we have intellectual and developmental disabilities as well that is used between government and community services and other areas. But terms like varied abilities puts more focus on the other side of the coin. That puts emphasis on different capabilities of an individual rather than the actual disability. As Brian mentioned, we're all going to have varied abilities at one point in our lives, and will require support services to top up whatever is required to continue our day-to-day routines. We've heard of other terms like mixed abilities and diverse abilities as well. Mixed abilities, it has basically two definitions. One of the meanings of mixed ability is as a politically correct phrase used to describe someone who is abnormal physically or mentally. Mixed ability can also refer to students of different physical or mental abilities that are taught together in a single classroom. But as of about 2011, mixed abilities became more of an accepted term to recognize persons with special needs. Now, diverse abilities means that people's abilities are varied and that different abilities all have value included in all parts of our lives, including community work, education, communication with the government, and enjoying social relationships and so forth. This is pretty similar to the term varied abilities that Brian and Rena uses. Again, it's about how we use these terms depending on the situation and the environment that we're in. And now we have another clip here that I would not mind touching on relating to the housing projects and the model that they used. Let's check that out.
right?
Let's back up a bit, yeah, because there's an array of solutions that different people need. So at the same time, we built, between 2012 and now, we've built three other group homes. One is specialized for people with significant behavioral issues.
By group home, you mean three or four, like the conventional group home models?
Okay. Well, there's nothing conventional about the way we do it, but the conceptually conventional from a number point of view. In that case, it's five people living together, severe behavioral issues, specialized windows, walls, systems. But we've also developed a model that we tested and had independently reviewed, where it gave people independent spaces. So each person has a bedroom, a living room, and a support space. And that gives people safety. We also designed every room so there are two exits, so staff feel safe. Behavior issues dropped from the previous location they were in, same group of people, to a new building. The design made a difference. So we're not only involved in these large multi-unit buildings, but we believe as a sector we need to build a lot of the multi-units because they fill a lot of the spectrum. So don't forget, people are on a range of abilities and needs and support needs. So a lot of people don't need housing like we're building because this is built to B3 standards, fire safety standards, care occupancy-based, having 24/7. A lot of people don't need that. They need touch points. And hopefully there's enough being built out in the community. Other people need high-end support. They need staff 24/7 with them, and their social skills and the risk of things like environmental pieces setting them off are huge. So you can't have them in a building with hundreds of people and alarms and noises and people moving and sounds because those are all triggers. You got to build an environment that suits their needs. So there's a spectrum.
Yes. So what I learned about from Brian's segment on his dialogue on recent and upcoming housing initiatives is a belief that there is a change, right, guys, in how we address housing today to a more holistic approach. What I mean by that is we should address housing based on what is the individual's preference. If a person with varied abilities is not comfortable in a larger environment due to excessive noise, alarms, crowds, then a smaller occupancy model with the right supports is what their living arrangements should be. Now, for persons with significant physical to mild developmental disabilities, those with mental health to brain injuries, and seniors that wish to live in a place where they have their own space, allows for independence, personal growth, with safety factors built in, built to B3 code, you know, with the right touch points, and most importantly, have access to 24/7 care as needed, then a larger housing model is what may be more appropriate. Rena refers to this model as a multi-unit residential model. Having an understanding of the various housing models based on a person's need is important. However, Brian also spoke to the many steps that need to be taken before we can even build our projects. For example, it starts with a needs assessment. Who needs the housing? What talents do we bring to the table? And you create an opportunity list as the next step. You know, you have to talk about the land, the property availability, zoning restrictions, community engagement. It's so important that everyone must be on board, as Brian says. Eliminate any NIMBY concerns, so to speak. Engage partnerships with community agencies. I mean, they can build a place, but they're going to need these agencies to manage their lives with their expertise. Understand the financing phase, collaboration between community, government, and family. These were all great points discussed by Brian in that episode or in that clip. Let's also watch this next clip on the government role.
So the federal government has made a huge step forward, and we were very active, and all of us in the Intentional Community Consortium, advocating for housing that was inclusive and targeted to people with developmental disabilities. So they've articulated a target. Do I think it's a big enough target? No, doesn't matter. It's 2,400 units across the country over a 10-year period. Really,
was that,
not
was
a lot.
$100 million over 10 years?
No, dollar amount.
It was units.
It's units out of that multi-million dollar national housing strategy. In conversations with the government and the leadership, that's a minimum. they hope we go beyond it, but we're somewhat pessimistic that anyone else is getting on board as much as we were getting on board to this. So they set it out as a target to see, and they hope to surpass it. Now it's up to us as communities, as particularly the province, to step up and say we're going to hit and exceed that target, because it still is a provincial and often a municipal decision how much resources. So at all those levels need. Mm-hmm. So there are monies available. CMHC has the resources to loan and or contribute portion. I think CMHC will do up to 10% maximum contribution. They will lend you 95%, but generally I wouldn't want to be borrowing from them 95%. Our approach has been 20% from community, meaning donors and local community, 20% from levels of government, or 20 to 30% if you can get all the levels participating, and 50% of the residents themselves and their rent. And so they are the primary owners of the building. They should be. The tenants, it's their building. And we should never be giving everything to them or to anyone. Everyone should own it. And we also believe that community should own it. So if the community contributes, they have a responsibility to it. So it's not government alone. But the government has set a framework where you can access resources. So there are seed funds up to, I think, $500,000. For early development. Now that's a high target.
Pre-development costs,
site plan, yeah, zoning, yeah. Getting your drawings together. And then depending on your project, you're gonna have to be pretty far. You're gonna have to go pretty deep to get finalized the CMHC loan and contribution. But you can have early insight into whether you're gonna get it by having conversations. And I can say the CMHC in Ontario has dedicated a lead person for working with the DS sector. So any agency or organization or family or group who's building multiple units wants to apply to CMHC, there's a person who understands our sector. We did a whole training for their finance teams, their intake teams, and walked them through our building and why we're different, why one unit isn't one family. Mm-hmm.
See, this particular segment of the program where Brian Keshen discussed the government role is very important, quite important. In 2018, the federal government, as you all know, made a huge step forward by introducing the National Housing Strategy. The federal government articulated, I believe, 2,400 units over a 10-year period. Brian mentioned it is up to us, communities, and a province to hit this target and, yes, exceed this target. Brian mentioned that there's monies available for the housing project. I mean, central market and housing will end up to 95%, I believe, but you don't want to get to that 95% anyways. But ENRENA's funding philosophy is 20% from the community by way of donations, 20 to 30% from all levels of government, and 50% from the residents with their rent. I mean, after all, they are the primary owners. Brian also mentioned that the CMHC in Ontario has designated a lead person that understands our sector. I thought that was very important. And RENA, this organization, does facilitate ongoing training to ensure that CMHC understands that one unit is not necessarily a family. Three people choosing to live together in an apartment is a unit. Also noteworthy is a statement that a criteria for a successful project is close to transit, access to community, distance to community agencies, medical community, and employment.
Yeah. Thanks, Lino. That was well said. You know, quite informative. Let's take a look at this next clip where he actually talks about the infamous wait list.
Yes.
Right, so I believe the numbers are greater. So let's say the population of adults with developmental disabilities is somewhere between 90 and 100 and something thousand.
Okay.
We know that 68,000 people with developmental disabilities are on ODSP as an indicator. So that's just that group.
Okay, so the number of adults in Ontario with developmental disabilities sits at about 90,000 to 100,000. 68,000 persons in Ontario are on ODSP. Ontario has approximately 14,000 plus persons on the DSO residential waitlist. Toronto has about 5,000 to 6,000 people on the DSO residential list. 20 years of not building any supportive or affordable housing tacked on a 40-year wait list. The challenge is quite significant. What I've found to be very important part of the discussion is where Brian said we, I presume the community, must work with the builders and developers to see if they can include a portion of their housing for support units. Look, builders have a huge role. However, it is expensive for them to build according to the new safety codes. Wider hallways, B3 standards, which is very costly. Staircases, fire safety, sprinkler system. List goes on. Margins become very tight. This is why a successful multi-unit residential project and smaller group home models require a collaborative effort from different areas, such as the private sector, families, and even government. Developmental Services Ontario, DSO, and the DSO navigators, they do have an important role in steering the parents and the caregivers to think about the succession planning. For example, understand where resources can be found for self-fund group homes, etc. However, as Brian stated, these initiatives do not create housing or reduce the lengthy provincial or local housing and support wait lists. That's just my two cents about it.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. So, gentlemen, before we close this discussion off, just let's have a listen to this final clip that Brian mentions about caregivers.
The time you're
the highest, so when we compare cancer caregivers for cancer patients or cancer, any other issue, the highest numbers are in DS sector for lifetime caregiving. So people who have a lifetime of having to do that kind of work, and we don't recognize it.
No, we don't.
So recently, there's an initiative called the 3CE, which is a caregiver-focused effort. And we're starting to hear it. So Petro-Can jumped on the bandwagon.
That's
others,
right?
That's so
right. That's right.
That whole caregiving attention.
I love it.
3 years ago, I put forward a proposal that we do have a caregiver recognition day. Start with that, at least. And then we should be looking at tax values and other things and supports and training and so on. We did a sort of research on what training components that we do could be provided to families. It's a life mission, and the end of it is not, so what happens? That's the problem. What happens next to my kid? And Rena won't. No one will do what you do for your kid. And that's just the reality.
Exactly.
But that's true for all of us.
So growing up with a parent who was a nurse, I totally understood the importance of caregiving. Mm-hmm. Our society does not realize how tireless these caregivers work daily to raise their family members with special needs. Brian had highlighted the importance of our society recognizing caregivers. This acknowledgement will let people know the struggles that caregivers go through on a daily basis and truly appreciate what they do. Brian mentioned our mortality. I don't know about you guys, but I've always said I'm going to live forever. Now, we all have that mindset that we can live forever. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Some caregivers share this mindset. However, honestly, they're actually too busy coddling their loved ones and just not able to address the long-term care plans due to their current busy lives. They just really have a lot on their plate right now. Now, if they can truly accept that reality that they cannot live forever, if they can minimize sheltering their loved ones, and if they can access available resources and assistance programs, then these caregivers can plan early the future for their loved ones so that the family is prepared in case of any calamity or tragedy. Now, we believe that planning your loved one's future in a timely basis is critical so that the caregiver can be content that once they are no more, that they know their loved one will be looked after.
Well, gentlemen, we've come to the end of our show. I want to thank the both of you for being guests today, for appearing on today's program, and sharing your viewpoints on the important subject matter covered by our very first guest, Mr. Brian Keshen, Executive Director of RENA, on our first webcast. That's, what, a year ago, right?
Yeah.
I believe that quote Brian referred to in his program warrants repeating. I don't know if you remember that, but let me just go over that again. If I'm not for myself, who will be? But if I'm only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? That's so poignant.
Yeah.
All of our webcasts can be seen on Your TV Halton, Cogeco's community channel, covering local news and productions in the Burlington and Oakville area. You can also find our episodes on YouTube and cribwolftalks.com and various social media platforms. If you're willing to share your story and be a part of a future webcast, please write to us at info@cribwolftalks.com. Thank you once again for watching Cribwolf Talks. And remember, let's help those within our vulnerable community by enriching their lives with a place they call home that is safe, affordable, and inclusive. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lino. Bye.